Do you believe in free will? Time was, people believed our destiny was in God's hands and all you had to do was trust in that plan. But for a long time, science and philosophy have been seen as counterpoints to that view. We're rational beings in control of some of our destiny, at least, right? Well, Dr. Hannah Critchlow says, actually, I think we were right the first time. Free will does not exist. And that's based on her research on our brains and how they interact with our genes. Hannah Critchlow is a neuroscientist and her new book is called The Science of Fate. Hannah, welcome to Life Matters.
Hello, Hilary. Delighted to be here with you.
So you're really swimming against the tide of globalist culture here, aren't you? The idea of the self-actuating individual who can achieve anything they want if they try hard enough. Tell us what you've found in your work that's led to you to argue that that's not true.
Well, exactly. You've kind of hit the nail on the head there. Over the last 20 years, there's been this wonderful idea of free will on steroids, if you like, that we have this unlimited capacity for agency. We can change our brains in any way that we like. If we just try hard enough, we can, you know, maybe think our way out of depression, or we can, you know, pick up a musical instrument and anybody can play it as long as they just keep on practicing, or that we're all born to be mathematical geniuses. If we just, you know, keep on trying with the maths and the algebra. By the way, I'm hopeless at maths, so I keep on using that example. Maybe I wish that I could be a bit better at maths. But I think perhaps, although this idea of unlimited plasticity is quite a positive, alluring vision, in some ways, actually, I think it can be harmful for people, and that perhaps it's more empowering to accept that we each have our individual strengths, but we also have our own weaknesses or idiosyncrasies or flaws as well. And that's part of the way that we are so wonderful as a species. We have this capacity to display this wide breadth, this great array of different behaviours. And that's what gives our society strength, is that we are all individual, we are all unique. And that comes down to the cartography of our mind, which we're just discovering more and more about over the last 10, 15 years, as we've developed new technologies, which mean that we can now peer into the brain as never before and see conscious moving mammals and watch their brain architecture and their brain anatomy actually change using this plasticity as these mammals are going around navigating the space around them and making decisions and interacting with other individuals.
You're suggesting, aren't you, that some of those skills and capacities that you argue do make us individuals are laid down really early in our lives and in fact can't be changed. I mean, that's quite a depressing thought for some people, that some of the things that might have fed into their hopes and dreams for their future might not be true. How can you be sure that that's what's going on?
Well, so as I was saying, there's these amazing technologies that are allowing us to see these adult mammals kind of moving around. But we're also able to now peer into the brain of a baby as it's neural circuitry is being formed, the foundations of its thinking, if you like, for the rest of its life is being formed. And we're able to watch that baby's brain develop from just 20 weeks gestation, so halfway through pregnancy. And you can see that there's particular anatomical signatures or fingerprints, if you like, in the brain that give an indication of some of the behaviours that baby might display later on in its life. And at the moment, the focus of this research is on medical conditions. So they can see kind of signatures within that neural circuitry that are relevant and correlate with ADHD, for example, or autism, or even symptoms that might not emerge in that baby's life for decades down the line, like schizophrenia or major depressive disorder. Now, interestingly, there's lots of genes that are related to those conditions that I've just mentioned in that baby's brain. But there's also genes that encode other behaviours as well. For example, how intelligent you are, your IQ, your longevity, how long you're likely to live even, has got quite a high hereditary basis. How resilient you are to developing a mental ill health condition. Even your socioeconomic status, your social economic group that you might later be in. All of these types of behaviours seem to have a high hereditary basis. So that means that there's something in the region of between it can be between 40 and 80-90% having this genetic predisposition towards these different characteristics or temperaments. So much in the same way as we accept now that our height or our eye colour or our hair colour has a strong biological basis. It's got, you know, it's largely down to our genes. We're also uncovering lots of data that are indicating that actually these more complicated behaviours also have a biological undercurrent, and the majority of the genes that are involved in these complex behaviours are involved in directing how those nerve cells in your brain as a baby get wired together to form the very complicated, intricate, beautiful neural circuitry that makes up your brain, where there's about 100 trillion connections. So it's the genes that are really directing how that connectivity occurs, and also how your brain gets its energy and its nutrition, if you like, from the surrounding areas.
So I guess a lot of people would be happy to accept that conditions with a behavioural expression like ADHD or autism or schizophrenia that you mentioned before might have a genetic basis. But how well can we pinpoint the genes and the brain connections that deal with being rich or poor or successful in love or otherwise? Things like that, aren't they more about either the conditions you grew up in or the kind of basis of your personality?
Now, specifically talking about whether you're rich or poor, for example, the researchers that have been looking at that particular question recently and have come up with a figure of around 44% of a hereditary basis for socioeconomic status, their argument is that actually the fact that we can identify the genes that are involved in whether you're rich or poor, for example, actually is a positive thing, because it's helping us to see that we are creating a much more equal society, whereby you can actually start to identify the biological factors that are involved rather than those that are being kind of implemented there due to social kind of inequalities, if you like. So that research was done in the UK and Scotland in particular. This is partly why I wanted to write this book now. Because there is this slew of information that is coming out from the genomics revolution, where we're now able to sequence our individual 3.2 billion base pairs of nucleotides that make up our very unique, very individual DNA code, which instructs how our bodies and our brains are put together and how they operate. We're now able to sequence that information for individuals for less than $1,000 and in less than 30 minutes. And there's lots of projects that are underway across the world, which is giving rise to huge amounts of data that are telling us about the genetic predisposition to all types of different characteristics in our life, whether it's a propensity to diabetes, for example, or obesity, or whether it's particular vulnerabilities to certain mental ill health conditions, or temperaments or personalities later on in life. So there's a slew of information that's coming out, and there's also all these incredible new neuroscience technologies like optogenetics, connectomic kind of data analysis, which is allowing us to really study the minutiae of the neural circuitry in brains. And together with other technologies, this is raising some really important ethical questions. And in particular, I'm thinking about the fact that, I don't know whether you heard of the rogue scientist in China in the summer of 2018. Mm. He announced at a conference, the scientists that were attending the conference were really, you know, their jaws dropped at this news. But he had implemented a new technology that didn't just read the sequence of DNA, but went in and edited the sequence of DNA. And he'd employed this technology to edit embryo's DNA. And what he was trying to do was, he explained, try and change the genes in these embryos so that they conferred a resistance or an increased resistance to HIV infection. Now, interestingly, the genetic changes that he made have also been implicated in enhanced learning and memory skills. And two baby twin girls were born that year. And, you know, scientists have been in outcry of the fact that he has used this technology without proper ethical consideration or ethical approval from his hosting institution. And he's since been sacked from his institution. And I believe he might have actually been imprisoned for the work that he did. But this has happened. This has gone on. And there's other technologies that are also coming out. So, for example, commercial companies leaping on these findings slightly prematurely, I have to say, I think. And they're suggesting that couples that are undergoing IVF can genetically screen a number of different embryos, and they can have a look for genes that are linked to IQ or genes that are linked to a resilience to autism, for example, and they can selectively then pre-implant the embryos that they want. So for a price, this is being already offered to couples who want to have children. So as a society, I think it's important that we start discussing what do we really want from our society? Do we want to create a homogenous, society where we take out... Down syndrome is one example, for example, where I believe in Iceland there's all couples are now selectively screening out Down syndrome.
Yes, and as a parent of a child with Down syndrome, that gives me pause for great reflection myself and for a lot of other people I know. We're speaking with Dr. Hannah Critchlow, who's a neuroscientist, and her new book is called The Science of Fate. And Hannah, as you've mentioned, there's a whole slew of ethical questions that arise out of the science and the research that you're doing. I want to talk for a minute about parenting, because as parents listening, we might start to wonder how much of a role we actually have in raising our children. When we look at nature versus nurture, what are your conclusions about which one is uppermost, or what we can say about how they interact?
Yeah, so people like to say, oh, is it nature or nurture? Kind of put them pitted against each other, they're versus each other. But actually, the latest research is really showing how utterly intertwined the two are. So there's this amazing new field, emerging field, called epigenetics, which researchers are only starting to get a handle on yet, and there's still quite a lot of controversy in this field of epigenetics. But generally speaking, what we can see is that there's a capacity within our biology that allows us to allows us to ingrain memories and pass them down generations of mice or even possibly humans, so that we can help with our survival into the future. There does indeed seem to be similar epigenetic mechanisms that are apparent in humans and can be used in humans. And there's been some studies, very small studies, that have been conducted recently looking at the descendants of Holocaust survivors. And you can see that there's changes in the cortisol, the way that the cortisol kind of chemical in the brain that's involved in the stress response is expressed epigenetically as a result, possibly also as a result in these Holocaust survivor descendants, which might explain that traumatic memories are being passed down across generations in humans as well.
Dr. Hannah Critchlow, I have to ask you before we let you go, there's an aspect of your research that's got a lot of attention, and that's the idea that we might be able to predict the age we lose our virginity from brain imaging or from our genes. Is that possible?
Yes, it is. So there's some genes that are involved in our impulsivity and compulsivity behaviours, and particularly, so it's going back to this nucleus accumbens brain region and the dopaminergic release in it and our sensitivity to that. So there's, you've probably noticed it, there's some people that are just much more impulsive than others, and it's important for us to have impulsive people in society, because you need some people, a certain proportion of people within a group to be able to take risks comfortably in order for progress to possibly occur. And sometimes that impulsivity can be paired with compulsivity. So doing something even that you've impulsively done, even at the expense of yourself and others. And that's where, unfortunately, problems such as drug abuse can occur, or alcoholism. And it's almost like those compounds have kind of hijacked that that wonderful pleasure circuit within the brain. But similarly, those genes that are involved in impulsivity and compulsivity, the genetic changes there can be used to predict with a small amount of accuracy kind of what age you might lose your virginity.
That is truly terrifying. So does all this research mean that we are less responsible for our decisions, for our behaviours that we think that we're rationally choosing to do because it's already wired into our brain?
I mean, to some extent, yes. Yeah, to some extent, yes. And so what do we do with that information? Because I think that as we start to learn more and more and more, we'll have to start to accept the idea more and more that we are more like pre-programmed machines than we previously may have thought. So what do we do with that information? Well, I think really we need to start accepting each other a little bit more, accepting ourselves a little bit more, you know, and being able to identify our own strengths and weaknesses can be a positive thing. And to try and make our environments to be structured in such a way that we are supporting and nurturing each other's individualities, and having an appreciation that actually this is a positive thing for society, and it's something that we need as a species in order to survive, is that we can each be slightly different in the way that our behaviours exhibit, and that is a result of this beautiful way that our cartography of the mind with these 100 trillions of connections is laid down in our brains, and that gives our species strength.
It's good not to categorise people too. It will be fascinating to see what we can discover from the brain. Personally, I think the courthouses of the future are going to be fascinating places, if you're right. Dr. Hannah Critchlow, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Dr. Hannah Critchlow is a neuroscientist at the University of Cambridge. Her new book is called The Science of Fate.